Are you ready for phase two? It was a dark and stormy night. We've been talking about the self and the fact that it leads to reflections on two sides: what's the nature of religion and what's the nature of science. So we'll talk about the nature of science this afternoon. Sandy asked, could you say a little bit more about metaphor? Might be a good time to put this in, that what really interested Jung was the individuation process. How we have to go through certain things in life to activate this inner process which generates individuality, self, and how that all works. It seems to borrow facets from every conceivable domain, all world religions, science at some points, and that is basically what interested him. What world religions say, take as objective truth, Jung saw as descriptors of that individuation process. So that, let's take Christianity, you know, the virgin birth, the manger, all these various dimensions of either the Jewish story, the Christian story, I think a little less, but still in some places, the Hindu story, the Muslim story. He saw those images in the religion as symbolic of different phases of this developmental process. Of course, it angers those religious traditions, but then, you know, he would come in, what we've talked about today, that a literal understanding of those religious traditions is passé. We have a new demand put on us. So he doesn't feel that he's doing violence to any religious tradition, but to show how its truths are relevant at a certain level. And that's what I mean by metaphor. Symbolic of a certain phase of the process. The big one being what we talked about this morning, the spirit. The spirit as symbolic of how the psyche can move us forward.
I'm thinking of fractal geometry, about how literally at every level the image is a repetition of the same thing. So that would fit, that it fits, that, you know, that it's not, whatever's happening is not different on the individual level than it is on the collective level. It's all the same process in each place.
Okay, so this afternoon we'll move to science. The part of the self experience that led Jung to reflecting on the scientific method and the nature of the material world is synchronicity. I've given you a very quick definition of synchronicity. We'll read it, and I imagine it. Most of you know what this stuff is anyway, but if it's clear, we won't spend any time on defining it. Synchronicity, this is page 3. Synchronicity consists of a symbolic image constellated in the inner psychic world, a dream, for instance, or a waking vision, or a sudden hunch originating in the unconscious, which coincides in a miraculous manner, not causally or rationally explicable, with an event of similar meaning in the outer world. Is everybody comfortable with that? The question is, how does that happen? That's the big problem. It poses two problems. First of all, it posed a problem for you. Because we talk about the symbol creating capacity of the personality as being something inside the person. But obviously, if these symbolic events can occur in the physical world outside the person, then the symbol creating psyche isn't only psychological. It's not only inside us. It creates a problem for the scientific method, because there's no way to investigate this. There's no way to conceptualize or investigate how it is that the material world can operate symbolically. This is the dilemma we'll be spending the rest of the day with. The discussion got interesting when Jung's friendship with one of the discoveries of quantum physics, Wolfgang Pauli, took on sort of the form of a permanent lifelong dialogue, which has been published in one of the books, Atom and Archetype, which is listed on the website. That's their correspondence. Jung was so grateful to Pauli, because Pauli, as a scientist, could admit, yes, this is an issue. Science can't explain this, just as psychology can't explain this. And that means that our ideas are inadequate and need to develop, both psychologically and scientifically. They really didn't get much past that. Acknowledging this is an area for research, it's a valid area for research, but we don't know what to do about it, but at least let's keep the question open. And I think what Pauli could offer Jung was the confidence to keep the question open without the fear of being called, as he has been so many times, esoteric or flaky or whatever. And Pauli was grateful to Jung, first because of Jung's help to him in his own personal life, and second of all, supporting his curiosity to delve further into what is the nature of the scientific method. The link, the theoretical link in science that makes this a fertile discussion is quantum physics. So Pauli says to Jung, how do the facts that make up modern quantum physics relate to this other phenomena explained by you with the aid of the new principle of synchronicity? So that on the psychological side, the phenomenon that they're trying to explain is synchronicity. The theory in physics, which for the first time ever makes it not completely ridiculous to explore the phenomenon of synchronicity, is the quantum action of the electron inside an atom. And we need to spend a little time on what that is, how those two relate. People know that stuff. A little time on that. If you go back to classical physics, everything was explained by causality. Everything that exists, exists in a state that has been caused at one time or the other. True, we may not be able to measure and calculate all those causes. Why do I move my hands this way and not that way? But from the Newtonian world, all of that has had a cause. If everything is the result of a cause, there's no place for synchronicity. Synchronicity is a sort of strange aberration in the behavior of things. With quantum mechanics, all that changed. Try to make it very simple. If you want to, we can go into it more. But when you zap a gas with atoms, let's take neon, and you zap that gas with either heat or electricity, it energizes the electrons inside an atom. Those electrons will jump up a couple of orbital levels, and then they'll jump back a couple of orbital levels. And when they jump back, then light is given off. That's how light is produced from a heated gas. The conclusion that was reached, however, is that when that atom is bombarded with energy, there is no way of predicting the way that electron will move in the energized atom. It seems to move on its own free will. statistically, you can say there's a 75% chance this electron energized from a lower orbit will go up to an upper orbit. You can say there's a, you can predict the probability, but in any given case, that electron, it may go up to that higher orbit directly, or it may stop along the way. And once it gets up there, it may fall back directly, or it may fall back, making little stops along the way. And so the movement of the individual energized electron is not causally determinable. It's not that they don't know enough to predict it, it's that it is unpredictable. So for the first time, this idea of unpredictability entered into mainstream science as a respectable feature of nature. So that is the beginning of the dialogue between Pauli and Jung. Pauli could realize, oh, this unpredictability of the electron, this unpredictable nature at the heart of the atom, leaves room for synchronicity, which we never had before, even mentally, because we thought everything was causally determined. We now know that things are not all causally determined, that there's a sort of random activity in the very microscopic level of material world. And so Pauli could, and I think was one of the first to really entertain, oh, here's the link. Unpredictability in the atom, apparent unpredictable events in synchronicities, maybe that is how there is some link between what Jung is seeing about synchronicity and what we're seeing about the movements of electrons. Is everybody okay with that? That's what Pauli says to Jung in the third quote there. Acausality in microphysics is a sort of preliminary stage for your concept of synchronicity. Acausality would be this idea that the movement of electron isn't causally determinable, or isn't causally determined at all. It's sort of, the electron seems to have its own haphazard way of behaving. And that then was where the guys could start discussing. Thinking maybe on this term, there was some basis of a rapport between physics and psychology. So Pauli wrote, what is developing is indicative of a close fusion of psychology with the scientific experience of the processes in the material world. It is probably a long journey, emphasize long journey, one we are only just setting out on, and it will especially entail, as a modifying factor, constant criticism of the space-time concept. Now, why does he bring in space-time concept? Yeah.
I believe that in quantum physics, it's proven that if you are looking at one space, that it's difficult to completely look at time also.
Right, there's the indeterminacy principle. Yeah, I think you could say that.
So you can't really prove
space in quantum physics is a relative term, because we know if you take an atom and you separate its particles by thousands of miles, and you activate one particle, the other particle thousands of miles away responds as if it were back in the atom again, as if space didn't exist. So that's where it shows up in physics. And in psychology, both these guys felt that psychology challenged the space concept in physics, because and in psychology both, how is it that the psyche, which we think is inside, is also outside? What is the nature of space that can be the case?
There's also the issue that time and space time is only one dimensional, and whereas in synchronicity or other things happen in an order where something seems something else, you know, like it happens at the same time or
out of
sequence of time, and the space-time context does not allow for the movement of time anyway except forward.
You can have a dream first, and then the event happens, as if to say that the dream was either ahead of the event or that the event was behind the dream. Doesn't fit with our understanding of time. And the fact that this discussion is occurring at all, they regard it as possibly synchronistic. I am deeply impressed by the conformity of physical and psychological thought processes, which can only be regarded as synchronistic. So apparently we're not only at a period where we have to reevaluate what religion is, but we also have to reevaluate what science is and what space and time are based on this phenomenon of synchronicity. As I said, they didn't get much past that, but they spent their correspondence trying to refine, restate, re-examine these questions. I don't think we know what will ever come out of this, but Pauli could say as a scientist, well, these are facts, and they're facts we can't explain, and the growth of science has always been taking account of facts it didn't have the capacity to explain, and then developing a theory to explain it. Who knows where this will go? On the spatial aspect of the psyche, some quotes referring to what I've said. The central structure of the collective unconscious, see where I am? Bottom of three. Cannot be fixed locally, but is a ubiquitous existence. It must not be seen in spatial terms, and consequently, when projected onto space, it is to be found everywhere in space. I even have the feeling that this peculiarity applies to time as well as space. So we don't know where the psyche exists. And we don't know what matter is, that it can behave this way. Questions? Is that all clear? Yeah.
I even have the feeling that this peculiarity of time as well as space, does that mean that what is happening now has implications for all of time?
You know, it might, where I think it really is when you dream of an event before it happens. How can that be that your dream seems to break through the chronology of time? Has anyone had such an experience? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. It plays havoc with the linear conception of time.
Does it always have to be a dream, or can it just be like a thought?
Could be a thought.
Okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be something that you do when you're sleeping, it can happen.
No. The easy way to remember it is the coincidence between a dream image and an outer event. But that is a little too limiting. It can be a thought, a fantasy, a premonition. And I think it can also be a series of outer events that happen, you know, way more often than would logically be possible. But usually there's some interconnection, whether that's a dream or a feeling or an emotion.
Sometimes you feel something, and then something happens, you can't really prove it, but it's something that you just sense, or...
Yeah.
Or your interpretation of what you were thinking versus what happened. You see my point?
Yeah.
You can't always prove it, but you...
Well, I don't think you can ever prove it. This is the great problem, that our concept of scientific proof doesn't apply to these things. Yet, and so, you know, a lot of scientists will therefore dismiss it. But Pauli knew these happen. And the word you use, I don't know whether you realize it or not, that's so important, is that it feels important. That's the distinguishing characteristic. It feels important. So if you're going to take account of people's emotional life and take account of it seriously, you're forced to deal with this concept. So we kind of get to it by the back door, simply by knowing what it is that moves people's feelings. Anything else? Yeah.
I was going to say, in Native American and paganism kind of thing, a lot of times we talk about having animal totems, and I find there's times when those animals will show up. Physically, they will, certain hummingbirds will come in, a fox you may see on the side of the road or stuff like that. And if you see this happen more than once, you think, well, there's some information coming here.
Yep, that's it. I remember when I was in training in Switzerland, I lived at the top of a hill just in the outskirts of town. And there was a road that ran along the side of the woods. And I bet I had 3 dreams of foxes in about a week. And I would jog up there. The next week, a fox would start my jog, follow me the whole way, and follow me back. Yes, if you're a Native American, you'd call that a totem. Of course, the fox is Mercurius. Mercurius is our patron saint. Now, Native American societies will base their entire social fabric on this fact. You know, you go out, the kid goes out for his vision quest, and very often either the dream or the animal that approaches them first defines their role in the community. And so it's another principle. I think Jung calls it another principle of connectedness, which up to now we don't have a way of explaining. Too easily dismiss. But you can see societies that take it as the basis of their social organization. And certainly we try to help people understand its meaning in their personal life. Yeah.
Gary, is there any correlation between how these events or occurrences would happen with certain people? I mean, would it be that, like with you, you'd see the animals mostly, or somebody else would have dreams mostly, or somebody else would have more symbolic imagery rather than more...
I don't think so. No, but the idea is...
Somebody get it anyway.
Not so much that what... I mean, it might be, but I don't know if anyone studied it. Not so much what forms these show up in, but when they show up and how they move you. And when they show up is often when you're wrestling with questions of the self. As if to say then suddenly the whole world becomes a dream.
Receiving,
then
you get more and more and more messages. They all come to be home.
Yeah. The next point is that this dialogue with Pauli forced Jung to reevaluate his concept of archetype. Pauli influenced Jung in 2 ways here. First, Pauli's the guy that gave Jung the confidence to talk about synchronicity in the first place. This is something Jung did late in his life, and I think he was holding back from doing it because he knew he would be called some sort of flake. But Pauli could say to him, no, it's very important, publish on it. The other thing Pauli said is, you know, this is not explained by your concept of archetype. And so Pauli wrote to Jung, it seems to me that the term archetype is going through a phase of great change at the moment. And Jung wrote back, you are justified in demanding a new interpretation of the term archetype. Are you familiar with Jung's basic definition of the archetype? As an image-shaping factor.
Is it mental or...
Yeah, that's probably a little more accurate. The idea is that when the conscious personality hits a cul-de-sac and doesn't know on its own resources how to proceed, something is activated inside us, and that something is a capacity to produce images. That capacity to produce images, Jung just gives a word to, and he calls it the archetype. It is a structural predisposition. It is not an image, but it is the process of producing that image, which is generated when we hit a wall, and what is generated is the image that, when understood, will represent an understanding that gets us past the stuck spot. Sort of an internal feedback loop.
Does it hold energy? I mean, is it a form? Kind of like
that? The way he talks about it, it's a form. Yeah, it's...
Energy can come in.
Form, and then it is activated by energy, which would normally flow into life, but doesn't because you're stuck. And then, thus activated, it generates what you need to know to get to where you're going. See, it's very close to the idea of spirit.
It's not also the energy that's
produced. No, and it's not. He is not so clear here, but we should distinguish between an archetype and an archetypal image. Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds very nice. The problem is, what's it have to do with synchronicity? Apparently, the archetype must also reside in matter. How else could the material world operate symbolically? How did that fox get there? So Pauli forced Jung to reevaluate what he'd said, and at least publicly express that this business of archetype is way more complicated than he first thought, and that archetype somehow, in a way we don't know, extends into the material world. So that material world can be just as symbolic as the inner world. This then, yeah.
So can that be an image then? That can actually be a presented, can you call that a presented image?
Yeah, a synchronicity is a presented image.
Yeah, so many times in the material world. As a synchronicity.
As a synchronicity, always in the material world.
Yeah, okay.
You could say, you know, depending on how far you want to let your brain go here, you could simply say a synchronicity is a dream occurring in the outer world. I don't think that's incorrect. It sounds so crazy because we have no way of conceptualizing.
Okay, it doesn't always have to be like material, like an object, though. It can be a material dream aspect, right? It can be a material, it can be not hardcore materialized. Can it be just a pseudo-material?
What's a pseudo-material?
Well, it's a sense of... almost like a projection.
Oh, like a vision, maybe?
Yeah, almost like a kind of a projection or something that's kind of
I don't know.
Not quite materialized to the degree of the hardcore materialized box.
What he wants to talk about is basically material. The other place he feels that this occurs is possibly in disease.
Disease.
That just as a synchronicity presents an image in the material world, possibly the body likewise conveys an image in this disease. The clearest I've ever seen this was an absolutely workaholic physician who was diagnosed with a melanoma in the shape of the state of Florida. See, he could have dreamt of Florida, but his body became the Florida dream, except it was a disease. But the body doesn't care, disease or not disease. It just, the material world wants, very loosely here, but it's like this image wants to be expressed. Sometimes it chooses the dream, and sometimes it chooses the material world. And that material world can be a synchronicity, or that material world can be the body. Some of you know Anne McGuire's work. That's really how I got interested in this. And the story she tells is, have I told you this about the frown? Some of you have heard this. Not everyone's heard this. I think this happened before, she's a dermatologist in England, and it happened before she got into psychological training. And a boy was brought to her, and he had a big mustache of eczema, or psoriasis, just like this. And she said it made him look like a frowning clown. See, there's the image, a frowning clown. So she had to ask herself, why is this boy frowning? And she found out, to make a long story short, that there was great mistrust between the parents, and the mother suspected the father, I don't know rightly or wrongly, of unfaithfulness. And when that was clarified and the marriage was re-solidified, the frown went away. So that boy's face was the expression of that family's sadness. And it's not, I don't think we have too much of a leap to realize how the body can react if the soul is suffering. But the fact that it reacts so intelligently, conveying the image that is necessary to correct the cul-de-sac, that's the puzzle. How it is that the material world and the physiological world convey this image with an uncanny intelligence. And she goes through many, many, many examples of things like that.
Cul-de-sac, it's like a blockage.
Yeah.
But you can't, you're moving.
Your life's gotten stuck.
The only way you can go is back or stay stuck.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, in my case of the fox, I was in doubt. Should I be doing this? Have I made the right decision? And you can see in the case of the marriage, the block was this marriage is on the rocks. With that obsessive doctor, I don't think he ever got it. But he just did not spend enough time with his family. Yeah, no leisure. I met him, and he drove me nuts just talking to him. I can't imagine living with him. Major type A. So the image, not related only to the dreams, but to the body. There's a whole world of research waiting to be done there. Not many have done it. McGuire is one. Marion Woodman, I think, has tried to do her part in that. And then this whole issue of synchronicity in the material world operating with intelligence, symbolically with intelligence.
Okay, I'm back to that, where I was before. I reframed it as coming into being. So if it starts to inform you, can you get it on a level before, when you get it, but can you get it before it has to manifest to the ultimate degree?
Yeah, that's the idea, so that when it does, it's sort of the last...
So even an illness...
The last, yeah. Definitely we're trying to get it before it manifests. Definitely. I think you can look at global. I mean, then the question is, where do you draw the line to what's a synchronicity and not? I would say global warming is. I personally think the war with Islam is synchronistic too. Mm-hmm. That it's got a message, and that's why it's. I hate to say that's why it's occurring, but that's one level of dealing with it. Right. Right. Right.
When you can only face something, one of the things that Anne McGuire talked about being a dermatologist, she said that she discovered that things that were happening on people's skin, particularly on the face, had to do with ego stuff, because they had to look at it in the mirror. And that's one of the things that synchronicity does. I mean, it manifests so much that you have to look at it. You have to face it. And it becomes then the dialogue. In other words, it's there, you're here, and then there's a capacity for something to start moving back and forth. Until there's the other, there's no capacity for dialogue.
Yeah, the key then is to absorb the image that's being conveyed. Well, the challenge that, as I said, that it puts to psychology is to re-examine what is the nature of the symbol-creating process, and how do we begin to visualize that the symbols are generated in dreams, in the material world, and in the body. The challenge this puts to science is science doesn't have a method that is adequate to investigating these phenomena. Pauli knew that was a problem. Jung says to Pauli here under D, the positivistic attitude of natural science does not produce any holistic concept of nature. This prevents the appearance of any possible holistic governing of nature. Do you understand what he means by holistic concept of nature? And what's the positivistic attitude of science? Yeah, if you can't, as I go, if you can't measure it, stick it. If you can't measure it, poke it, put it in a box, it doesn't exist. And I think, you know, what's one of the key qualities of what science considers data? Repeatability. Some of you heard my story about the guy who guy I worked with, who we got rid of his diabetes in an analysis, and it stayed away for a couple of years. Eventually came back, but still, it got him 2 free years. And I told that to a physician, and I said, "That's a fact." He said, "No, it's not. It's an anecdote. Mm-hmm. It's only a fact if it's repeatable." And the problem in our discipline is we're dealing with individuality, which by definition is not repeatable. So how do we develop a method for investigating as fact what is non-repeatable?
Well, in science too, they limit their variables. So in any scientific research, if you really look at it, there are variables that are acting on the data or on whatever they're looking at that are not included in their measurements. So in reality, if you bring in other variables, you're going to skew what their results are. So they're truly not holistic in that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So they just want to leave things outside the box.
Yeah. And again, I think Pauli, to his credit, realized these are valid experiences, and we don't have a method for investigating them. Mm-hmm. And just like we talked about in our religious part this morning, we don't know where that's going. You also know that isn't, we don't know where this is going. But just as every scientific discovery has started with a fact it can't explain, this is the fact that science will stumble on until it gets to the point where it can explain it. And again, we're speaking in a long-term development here. And the problem then is that we've developed a method which only recognizes certain phenomena as worthy of investigation. And therefore, we don't have a method for regulating our view of life, because our view of life is only based on allowing certain phenomena to be called facts. It opens up too much of the world to a lack of our responsibility, because we only are concerned with this much of it. That's what he means by a holistic governing of nature. How can we govern what we don't acknowledge even exists? On the time bit, the idea of absolute knowledge is connected with the problem of reversed causality, the future event as a cause of the past one. So we're looking at situations in life where it looks like something bad is happening, but when we stay with that experience and try not to deny it or whitewash it away, later down the road another experience happened, which is a positive development, but it would not have happened had the earlier experience never occurred. So as some of you know, I spent part of my summers in France visiting a friend, and he told this story of buying his house. He and his partner were out looking for just the right house to buy for a sort of getaway place from rather crowded Switzerland. And they were biking through this rural part of France, and they were unexpectedly met by a thunderstorm. So all they had was their bikes and their clothes in the back. So they saw a sign that said, rooms for rent. And they pulled up to their place, and at that time it was raining hard. They were soaking wet. And the guy said, "I'm sorry, we're filled up. But I'll call around for you and get a place." So this fellow called around and said, "Yes, I've got a room for you at such and such a hotel. It's about a half mile up the road, you'll make it." So they biked to this next hotel and knocked on the door, and the guy said, "Well, we don't have any rooms. What are you talking about?" And the guy said, Didn't so and so call?" "Yeah, I called, but I told him we didn't have any rooms." He says, "But don't worry, I'll get a place for you." So he gives him yet another place. Same story. Third hotel. So the third guy finally says, I know one place that they were surely have a room. They have a custom in Switzerland called a gîte, in France called a gîte. There are hotels which by law you can only rent for a week at a time. The guy says, I know a couple that has a gîte. They're not supposed to, but they're my friends. You guys are soaking wet. I'll get you a place at the gîte." So sure enough, the gîte was open, and they got a place at the gîte. And finally got dried off, got a good night's sleep, got a good meal. I got up the next morning, or walking around, and my friend just had a funny feeling to go to this certain part of the village, and there stood a beautiful house. And ended up striking a conversation with a girl in French through the window, and turns out the girl is English. Pretty soon they switch to English. Like my friend's English is mother tongue. And the girl said, "Well, what do you do in this part of the country?" And he said, "Well, we told him a huge story. And then we're kind of looking for a place to buy. We don't know. We sort of like to get it. We like this area." And the girl said, "Well, come around and talk to my dad." Because then the dad's an Englishman, was married to a French woman who just had passed away, and the house was up for sale. Not on the market yet. He bought the house. See, had those things not occurred, he would have never gotten that house. So did that house waiting there in the future retroflect back and arrange these events to get into just that jeep next to just that neighborhood in which this beautiful house would go up for sale? It wasn't even on the market yet. That's the kind of thing that they're talking about. How do you explain that? We don't have any method. Science has no method for understanding this kind of time warp business that you get into when looking at these relationships between inner and outer events.
And is that somewhat covered by tractor science, you know, in the whole quantum science part?
That I don't know. You want to try and explain that?
Well, it's kind of like that whole thing about the house. You know, he put, it's a thought transference almost. He put the intent or the desire out there so there was an energy field that was out, and which coalesced with perhaps somewhat of the vision of what he had in mind and what the house, you know, resonated. So there's this, a dual resonance there. And somehow or another, bringing those two together under our sense of time. And so a tractor site is something that resonates with other things, and you know, it's a quantum physics concept that they bring each other together. It's like there's the positive meets the attracting, or the least reject, or whatever. You know, so it's the whole energetic coalition.
It sounds as good an explanation as any. I don't, you know.
It doesn't over time in our lives.
Something else is going on in time. That's the problem, which we don't know how to explain. That's a good explanation, but who knows?
A tractor
site.
A-T-T. Yeah.
Not
just tractor. No, a tractor. No.
Not a John Deere.
A capital. Yeah.
No, it is a tractor. It looks thin and so
It was talking about multidimensional time. You know,
concept. Mm-hmm. All these guys were doing was looking at this stuff and saying, you know, we don't know how to explain it, but let's stop sweeping it under the carpet. These are valid phenomena that we need to begin to try to conceptualize and explain. Nobody's saying they've explained them. And this, the other idea that comes in here is absolute knowledge. Have you ever come across that before in Jung? You get reverse causality, right? Mm-hmm. Again, remember, we are just speculating here, but is knowledge something that only human beings can have? Is knowledge something only that belongs to the knower? For example, how was it known for those hotels to be so frustrating? Something of an intelligence apparently was going on that three people in a row said no until he got to the right place. And Jung only tries to give us a word again and say, there's a kind of a knowledge in nature. I don't know where it is, but it is not connected to the ego. How did that fox know to follow me? Who else has had a synchronicity they can give us an example of? How? Yeah.
And was that friends have to do a little ritual and like burning bowl where you write down what you want to get rid of and then burn it and you try to load it from your life. And I wrote down, not letting myself have it all, and it meant something to me about, and like one part of my life would work and the other part would be fucked up. So that was what I wanted to let go. But I wrote it out a bunch of times on this piece of paper and burned it. And then on the way home, flew from Florida here, walked into a bookstore, and on the shelf was a book facing me that says, Mary Kay, you can have it all. Got it.
Boy, that is perfect.
That is
perfect. It had to be like black and white, like language for me. I mean, you know, like, God's like, hello.
How did that, it's as if we're asking, how did that book know to be there? That is what Jung wants to give a word to and say there's a knowledge going on, put it any way you want, in between events or intermingle with events or at the base of events, so that the world falls into place at times in a way that we just don't know ahead of time, but once we see it, we know it, and then was that knowing there before it happened in that book? Or somewhere connected with that book. He calls it absolute knowledge. I love the concept so much because, you know, today the philosophical trend of postmodernism says that there is no such thing as knowledge. There's only interpretation. But Jung is saying there might be a knowledge, which is apart from the ego. True, we know that through our interpretation, but that doesn't mean that that knowledge is nothing but an interpretation.
Jerry has another question.
Yeah.
So, according to quantum theory, which is pretty much probability, you know, you can maybe have it happen, maybe not, and there's positive probability associated. So, can you have something that possibly you do a rapport with, but maybe Mary Kay didn't go into that bookstore. She was headed that way, and she changed her mind. So is there a thought in Jungian power that you could intervene? Ultimately, it's going to come to you.
Right.
But that's kind of like stopping that thing becoming.
I think they're always talking about potentials, that these events are waiting to happen. But let's suppose, you know, let's suppose you were a person who had inclinations but disregarded them.
Mm-hmm.
You might not have gone to that bookstore. Yes, you can thwart these things. So, you know, one of the things we're trying to do in our work is help people respect these apparently quirky or not explicable sensations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Barbara.
Mm-hmm. I had an experience like that where I was coming home from the symphony on Fall Creek where they have that reversible ring.
Yeah.
And when I got to the place where you could get in it, the thought went through my head, don't get in that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, because I was in a hurry, and when I got up to 38th Street, the woman in the other lane pulled right into me.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to pay attention.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. See, again, how is that explainable? And I, you know, we don't know, but they're just trying to create words now and say, is that an example of reverse causality? Was there a future problem that you knew about that was arranging an event anterior to it? Once you're alerted to this phenomenon, which the rational mind says, but once you're alerted to this, I think through Jung and Pauli's saying, yeah, these are all valid things, they happen much more than you realize, and you're more likely to pay attention to the sentiments that allow them to happen. Yeah.
Can you control it to make it happen, though? I mean, instead of walking through life and kind of thinking about it or kind of this and that, can you make it happen?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
No, no, but when you ask, this has been in my life very much, the more I ask, the faster it happens. And in fact, the message I got, the download I got from Divinity was, it's your job to ask. We're not going to send anything to you until you actually do that. But that was my personal thing. But I mean, literally, you know, I do it, and sometimes the answer to the thing comes within less than an hour. And sometimes it's like the next day. So you can start answering.
Am I going to take that question?
I would say you've got to be careful what you ask for, and the universe, to me, knows more about what you need than I do. You know, and oftentimes things will come to me or won't come to me that I ask for. You know, so I've been incredibly blessed, but I've kind of said, you know, you just put me wherever you need me, which is kind of a little scary, because somebody really needs to say anything to it. So I don't... You can go with things.
Yeah, but you can ask, I think the process that I've seen is, if I can come up to a point and go, okay, here's some place where I'm struggling and I don't know what to do, that admitting, the letting go of the ego, and the admission that I don't know how to proceed is a very significant point. And then I go, okay, I need help here. Send me some information. And I actually use a phrase, something like that, so it's the belief of the ego, the admission that I need help, and the request for help, and then, lo and behold, it shows up.
You know, I think, I'll give an example, because I'll use this kind of idea often. So an example was, I was really wanting to get books on what I thought was stolen values. And that was sort of in my heart, and thinking about that. So I was out in Berkeley, and I had an appointment. And so, which I tend to do, I was an hour early, which was odd that I would be an hour early, but I was. So I said, okay, what am I to do? Where am I to go? And then as I was driving, I just started kind of paying attention. All of a sudden, I looked over, there's a bookstore called Guy Bookstore, which I'd never heard of. So I thought, okay, I'm supposed to go to Guy Bookstore. So I turned in, I went in the parking lot, I walked in, and right in front of me was a book called The Fabric of the Future. It's a book of 36 essays on feminine
violence. I have.
So I think you can ask and pay attention and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And I can't say every time I do that I have stories like that, but mm-hmm. I can tell you dozens of stories like that. And it doesn't have to be a big thing. Sometimes it's just a conscious. I'll be thinking about something and I'll ask for something and that thing will show, a person will show up at this grocery store or wherever. But I'm aware. I'm paying attention. So
because have you seen those pictures or something? And when you look at it, if you really look closely, you let your mind go. You see what the design that they want you to see. Mm-hmm. I can't do that. I mean, I seriously. I mean, maybe once in blue moon, I did one time. I was screaming, "Yeah!" But I can't. You know, now Brown County has something in Nashville, and I would just look at all of them. And I couldn't do it. I can't always do that. And it was a book my grandmother was showing me, and I was like, "Grandma, I can't see him. She's getting frustrated." I'm like, "I can't. I just can't. No matter how hard I try to put in my mind, I can't." So that's what I was trying to say. Because some things have happened. I understand. I can relate to what people are saying about things that happened. You know, it's kind of personal, but what I'm saying is, in general, I don't see how, I can't seem to call it. I can't seem to make
practice. I mean, all these are skills, you know, it's kind of like if you've never been on a horse, you don't, you know, if you only go get on a horse once every 10 years, you're never going to get any better. But all of these things, it's like anything else, it's something that you have to practice and then just see what happens. You know, you start doing it and then you notice what happens.
I would say just be open. Two things. You're here. You are here at this group right now, you know, to get some ideas. You know, I'm not quite sure how I want to say it, but, you know, I also believe that things appear to you when you need to know them. And you get them from the strangest people. You'll get it or from people, from places, from animals. Just be aware and open to suggestions. Yeah, basically. And it may come totally out of no place you're looking for. A lot of times when you go looking for stuff in a specific way and you say, I want this kind of answer, you don't necessarily get that kind of answer. You may get it in a different way. Just be open.
Well, should we be open to a break? And we'll come back in about 5 minutes, and we won't be long to finish up.